This is Harold Kimball continuing on tape 2, side 3, interviewing Paul Cohen. We're going to continue in a minute. All right. We were discussing Westinghouse today and what future it has in the atomic industry.
Well, it has a great deal of know-how because it has big staffs available. It is obviously adopting a policy of getting the money, getting income where it can in this field, and is doing this by taking government contracts for operating government facilities. It's the largest single operator of government nuclear facilities.
Do they hire? They actually hire the people to run them?
Well, they had a big staff, and I guess they hire additionally. They're just taking the contract for operating the Savannah River Laboratories, which is, you know, the staff there is of the order of 11,000 people.
Wow.
Well, it was formerly operated, currently being operated by DuPont Company, but they're getting out. The whole atomic energy effort has always been operated in that vein. The government agency itself does very little. It hires, it contracts people to do this work. Mm-hmm. And that's been from the very beginning.
Well, what about the atmosphere of atomic power? People protesting, laying down. How do you feel about that?
Well, a lot of it is, I think, obsessive. I don't share any of that. I've been perfectly comfortable with it all my life, all the time I've been operating with it. And but you can't see it, you can't smell it, and they can read about it and hear about it. So people get scared, and they're not terribly rational. There is the obvious thing, and of course, is what makes the protests and the attitudes significant, is that if you did have a bad accident, it potentially could be very, very serious. Now, the fact of the matter is that we've already had practically the worst accident we could ever imagine. That was a TMI-2, and nothing happened. And in fact, most of the adverse effects of the TMI-2 accident were generated by the people who were trying to manage it, you know, and deal with it at the time, you know, and fell all over themselves and unnecessarily scared people, misinterpreted the data, and all that sort of stuff. I was retired at the time, but I would get phone calls about it. People weren't asking for my advice and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, it's going to be hard to predict the fate of nuclear power, because there is that attitude, and well, it all depends upon how rough it's going to be to get electricity other ways. But it'll take a long time.
You were just discussing Three Mile Island, the only really big accident they've ever had in the history of nuclear power.
The truth is, if I may interject.
Sure.
Did it affect people?
No, the fact of the matter is the fact that it did not affect people. And it scared the it was used by some people inadvertently to scare the hell out of a lot of people.
Yeah.
But that was because they didn't understand what was going on, and the wrong people were doing the talking. But that's another matter. Mm-hmm.
So you actually how do you feel about the future? You just said not too positive.
Well, it's going to take a long time.
Make a comeback.
It's going to take a long time to overcome, well, first of all, for the need to become so pressing that it'll overcome enough of the resistance to become viable again.
You need to become...
I don't
Well,
I don't have much hope for it. Well,
you know, the fact that
10, 20 years, I don't know.
Well, people are so conscious of pollution, and this is the least fuel.
Well, you got to understand that we're a single issue country. Everybody's got an issue, but that's it. And the people who got the pollution issue feel strongly about that, and there are people who feel strongly about nuclear power. They don't match. They don't interact. It's just separate groups. And so they'll be against both. You got one group against nuclear and a group against pollution. Well, what the pollution people have done is to make the case for decreasing our needs and by recycling, et cetera, greater efficiency of the use of electricity and whatnot. But the fallacy with all of that, I mean, and the statements are correct. The only fallacy is that in order to implement them, they have to require an enormous capital investment. And the one thing this country doesn't have is capital. I mean, because we don't save money, you know what I mean? And we don't develop capital. And that's part of our problem today in the industry. We never put the money back into the business.
Yeah.
Say, you can make, they point out that you can make a refrigerator motor that will require half the electricity that the one does. Mm-hmm. But what they don't tell you is, what would it cost the country to replace, to convert, or to replace all the refrigerators, et cetera, to those motors? Now, you could mandate that all new refrigerators have to have these motors. But the lifetime of refrigerators is now 10, 15 years. You know, people don't go out and buy new refrigerators. The price has gone up, and they are pretty solid pieces of equipment. Yeah. You know what I mean? So that is mañana. The same thing with cars. We don't like low-powered cars. And we tried it, and the people fought against it. And people's desires can be quite contradictory. They go on two contradictory goals at the same time. Yeah. Don't try to explain it to them.
In other words, it's their own fault.
Well, part of it is. Yeah. I think in the end you have to say it is their own fault. Mm-hmm. And everything that happens to people is because of people. Right. And the nature of behavior.
All right, now we spent quite a bit of time on nuclear energy and stuff. Do you have any questions?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Paul, during your career, I recall that you received a number of honors in your
career. Oh,
I would like to have some discussion of that.
Well, I got the American Nuclear Society Award of Merit, I think in 69.
Hmm.
And
for what?
For my contributions along certain lines.
For what?
Oh, I don't know. I'll give you the text and you can read it.
I want a one-phrase statement.
I don't know why they picked out that particular one. Man I worked for at the time was bound and determined to get me some recognition. Mm-hmm. I never got too much recognition from the company, although I did get when you get stock at reduced price, an option.
Yeah.
I got a number of us got stock options for our contributions to the Naval Reactors Program.
Mm-hmm.
And but this was, it's a technical thing. I'll show you to it's hanging up on the wall.
Okay. The Westinghouse stock options, you got that about what years? Well, it had to be before you left at Pettus. Did you get any from the...
Before I left Pettus.
From Pettus. Remember what that was for?
Well, it was for my contribution to this. It was right after the submarine program, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
It was successful.
Okay.
I could tell you what my technical accomplishments were.
Okay, you got an award in 1975. You got what you have in your living room.
What I got now? Oh, that's an entirely different thing.
Okay, what was it?
Well, I became active in the
International Water Conference, which is a meeting held here in Pittsburgh every year, and has to do with the uses of water in industry. And in 1975, I got their award of merit for my contributions, both to the society and to the industry as a whole. And I've been elected a fellow of the ASME, a fellow of the AMS, and
fellow of ASME.
What's that stand for?
American Society of Mechanical Engineers.
And
American Nuclear Society.
Yeah, I know those.
Yeah. So I've gotten professional recognition. And then in 69, I published a book, which is was widely used and still referred to in the industry.
Yes, he's the guy who he's known all around the industry as.
I'm known all over the world because of the book. It's
technical.
What's the name of it? What was the name of it?
Water cooling technology of power reactors.
Water
cooling technology of power reactors.
Technology
of power reactors. Would you like to see the Russian copy of it?
No kidding.
Sure.
In Russian yet.
Yeah.
I think we should.
Yeah.
I can't read it though.
Is even
good for you.
A Russian.
Yeah, I think that's great. Good question.
Did you ever get any royalties?
No. It was before the royalty agreement.
Shut it off.
Okay. You never pressed up for royalties on your book in Russian.
I went to Russia for a few days in 81, I think it was, in February of 81.
Mm-hmm.
And this was in connection with the National Science Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
We were supposed to set up a meeting with the Russians on the scientific exchange, and we went to Russia to make the arrangements. But part of the arrangements was that there would be a Russian, we would send an American team over there, and there would be an American, a Russian team come over here, but Reagan abrogated the agreement. And so, but I had 3 days in Moscow.
I have another story, and this one I may as well leave it on the tape.
Okay.
It had to do with Khrushchev meeting with Kennedy. About these various interchanges.
Mm-hmm.
And Khrushchev says to Kennedy, you know, I see how avidly interested you are in these cultural and technical and other interchanges. He says, what's the point of your Jews meeting with my Jews? He said, why are you so specially interested in that?
That's good.
That's a true story.
Yeah, well, whatever. Anyhow.
Did you recognize that some of your Russian counterparts were?
No, they were not Jewish.
They were not Jewish.
The people I met.
Spoils the story.
I had met these people because I was aware of them technically, and I ran into them in meetings in the United States. I entertained them here, and they came here every once in a while. I entertained them at home. So I knew this very, very narrow, small segment of important people. So they were our hosts in Moscow. They treated us very nicely, etc. But it was just a snapshot. I was there in February. I remember it was warmer in Moscow than it was in Pittsburgh that week. Anyhow, but I never went back. But when they published my book, I'd heard about it. And I didn't have a copy, I didn't have anything. But another friend of mine went over there on a tour, a University of Illinois tour, and I gave him the name of this Russian engineer, a female, and he called her, et cetera, and she set up a date with him. And when she met him, she said, I want you to deliver this to Paul Cohen. So I got it. It's here, I'll show you.
In genuine Russian, with credits.
Oh, yeah, my name is on it. It's a translation.
Yeah, okay, very good. So there was exchanges going on how many years ago besides 81?
I don't know. There were a couple of teams going before. But the Admiral Rickover was actually was paranoid about the Russians stealing the secrets and so on. So we had major restrictions on publication while I was at Battersea.
Yeah.
We could hardly publish anything.
The Russians did publish throughout the commercial period limited descriptions of their technology and of their reactors.
It was, and every time they accomplished something, he would say that they stole it. And
that was on the naval stuff.
Yeah.
There were, I'm describing, with which incidentally I never had any contact with any of the Navy or military stuff or the Rickover stuff, but on the commercial side, I used to specifically look at Russian publications to see whether I could get some useful ideas out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was very little that in the end we could use, but they did have stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That they did publish, and of course they used a lot.
Mm-hmm. All right, the next, we're still on the wars, that's true. During the Korean War, did that affect your life? In the Vietnam War, what about that period?
I thought it was stupid, and I was sorry about it, and I was against it, etc. The major.
Stupid. Which was stupid, Korean or Vietnam? Or
the Vietnamese War. Well, the Vietnamese War.
Yeah.
Whether you're aware of it or believe it or not, the present financial situation in the United States stems directly from the Vietnam War, because the money that was spent on the Vietnam War effort was purely inflationary.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And this was pointed out by any number of people.
Yep, I knew it at the time.
It started the whole damn thing going.
I was for the war, but I recognized Johnson's blood, butter and guns.
Yeah,
very much like
that.
Right. Mm-hmm. What about the civil rights movement? Would you like to make any statements?
As I told you, I had legal friends, and I was a sympathizer, but I was not a participant.
Hmm. And the birth of the State of Israel.
Well, as an observer, etc., and I didn't, as I said, I pointed out to you, I'm not a Zionist, mm-hmm. and I'm not very religious, to get back to religious affiliations.
Yeah.
When it came time for approaching, bar mitzvah age, etc., for my son, we became affiliated with the Young People's Synagogue.
The Hebrew.
Well, that's they Institute. Hold their services at the Hebrew Institute.
Right.
They used to hold their services at the old Hebrew Institute across the street. It's since been torn down. That's where Maxim Power says.
Oh.
And we had 2 to 4 interns on this, et cetera. And then all of our friends, the people we knew, were affiliated with the. A lot of our friends, the people we knew, were affiliated with the Young People's Synagogue. Mm-hmm. And we remained affiliated with them.
Yeah. Would you describe that a little more? Because that's not an ordinary religious synagogue. I mean,
It was.
You're active in it.
Well, I'm not active in
no?
it. I'm not active in it. I was never really very active in it. But it was. It was founded by people who were religious, and some of them fairly orthodox, who had an aversion to organized religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did their own services. They never had a rabbi, etc. And to this day, they do not have a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
They do their own services.
In other words, anyone can go up and take over the
They select the board and the officers select the people who do that. And they have some very talented people there. Now, Dr. Rosenberg's been a member since day one, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And he is very learned, and he can give the whole service all by himself. And a lot of the kids who were raised there in that milieu were quite capable of doing the whole service.
Mm-hmm. So that's the background of your... You have one child? One son.
Yeah.
And he was bar mitzvah. How old is your son now?
Well, Howard is 47.
That's right. You did say that. And what is he doing?
He's a lawyer. He practices law in Delaware County.
What city would that be?
Well, he lives in Harrodstown, PA, but the county seat is Media, PA. It's right outside of Philadelphia. It's right next to the county next to
Philadelphia. Do you have grandchildren yet?
I have two. Yes, a boy and a girl and a boy. The girl is 16. The boy is 14. Yes, sir.
How about contrasting the way you were raised and the way you raised your son? Would you like to comment?
Well, my son, unfortunately, lived in a household that was dominated by my wife's illness.
By what?
My wife's illness.
I see.
See, for many years she was an invalid, and he didn't. He had no siblings, so he didn't have the benefit of that. But that, first of all, you can't compare them. My physical wants were taken care of when I was a boy, but I had no affiliation, no association with my parents, who were so involved in other day-to-day problems of just living and providing food on the table and all that sort of stuff, that there was no really, hardly any intellectual, there was very little intellectual discourse between parents and child.
Very common, yeah. I learned.
In this area, in this
period,
sure. Particularly in large families.
Yeah.
But I was closer to my one of my brothers, who was more of a role model for me.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
Yeah, because he wasn't married. He got married the same summer we did. But, when I was growing up, he preceded me in college and high school and all that sort of stuff. So, close enough. So it worked out that way.
Yeah, that was pretty common in big Jewish families with that kind of background. So you raised your son, how would you say?
Well,
freely.
No, he was given guidance, etc., and we tried to provide for him, he went to Y camp, the old Y camp, if you remember.
Oh, yes.
And he went to...
How did he get bar mitzvah?
But he had a tutor, Joe.
Well, the Y camp was really the JCC, Jewish Community Center.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it was the I don't know who ran it.
Yeah.
He went there a number of summers, long as I was there.
Now we're down to how do you view your accomplishments and your success?
Well, I didn't finish my career for a long time. In 49, I left the Naval Reactors Program, and I went to the Commercial Atomic Power Program, where I was responsible for one of the major factors in the success, or contributing factors to the success of the pressurized water reactor. The pressurized water reactor. That's the one that Westinghouse sells. And I was very, very active in that. And
what was that accomplishment?
Well, this is the use of boron as a forging chemical. It's a technical thing, but it required somebody to push it, to motivate it, and get it done. And I accomplished that, and that was prior to the major expansion of the Westinghouse in the nuclear power industry, because there was no industry before that.
Mm-hmm.
And following that, I was put into another unit. They figured they'd got everything all solved, but they didn't. But I was put into another unit.
In what year?
I'm just trying to remember. 62, 63, 63, 64, something like that.
No, if you're talking about Waltz Mill?
Yeah. And I was put into the so-called, they set up an advanced reactor division. I was put in that. And so I became
a consultant. I'd say that was about 1967.
Well, whatever. Mm-hmm. I became a consultant, mm-hmm. and I stayed in that mode until I retired in 71, I guess. No, 77.
Right.
Well, what do you view as your most important, significant accomplishment?
Well, I actually, I have two. Well, there are a lot of them in detail.
Yeah.
But my accomplishments were to solve many of the problems which had to be solved in order for both the Naval Reactors Program and the Commercial Atomic Program of that type to be successful.
Yeah.
And the chemistry aspect, I'm not, I have a worldwide reputation for that, to that point. Some because of my book, but others because of what I did.
Is there anything that you would do differently in retrospect?
Oh, very little. I wanted to retire early, and actually I had a deal worked out when I was in France for 2 years. I worked with the Westinghouse French licensee the last 2 years of my career, but the deal fell through. There was opposition to it. Or with the Electric Power Research Institute in California on a similar basis, but mm-hmm. it didn't work out. And I didn't plot my course, you know what I mean? I followed the natural flow of the stream, but mostly what I did was follow problems, you know. And regardless of people's feelings in general, let's face it, if somebody can solve a problem, he gets the job. Because the job don't recognize them. The problem doesn't recognize anything else.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything in your life you wish you could have changed then? That's a big question. Heavy.
Yeah, if we could have avoided some of the problems we had in my wife's illness, that would have been sure.
But it seems that you liked your work, right?
Oh, yes.
That's so important.
The fact of the matter is that anybody who can make his bread by doing something he likes, he got the world by the
tail. Got it made, right. Yeah. That's important in going into business, which I speak about.
Yeah.
There's too many people are not happy with what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I commented on that in my retirement party. I said, I never had a time when I didn't want to get up out of bed and go to work.
Good. Yeah. Howard, I'm sure you might want to ask a few things now.
Harold asked you some of the accomplishments. I specifically want a more explicit answer on at least a couple of items. You said you were a problem solver. That's right. And you mentioned the boron control. That was liquid boron control, the PWRs. But the general water chemistry area, I think. I'd like a little more exposition of that.
Well, the control of radiolysis in the of the water by the use of hydrogen additions. It wasn't original with me, but I implemented it. You wouldn't believe, but I had to go from Pittsburgh to Idaho so that I could crack at the valve on a hydrogen cylinder at 1 o'clock on a Sunday morning because everybody was afraid of it.
You had to open or close something?
Open the valve, you know. Oh, the first time we were going to do this, uh-huh. and nothing would do, but I personally had to go out to Idaho to do it and did it. In fact, I could have just done that, well, turned around and taken the next boat and played back. But you have to understand that hydrogen has got such a bad name in the submarine business, because we used to lose submarines when you charge the battery on the sun ray, conventionally, you generate hydrogen. And the hydrogen escapes and becomes forms an explosive mixture. So they, for as long as there've been submarines, they've been blowing them up with these hydrogen. Now along come these Meshuggahs, and they want to put hydrogen into a submarine. Yeah. I mean, how crazy can you get? So we had an enormous battle. It lasted 6 months until we finally persuaded everybody that it could be done.
Wait a minute. What you're describing is the hydrogen overpressure for reducing atmosphere.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And you did it.
Yeah, well, I wasn't the only one involved, but I was. I had a file doing that big by in 6 months.
Hydrogen overpressure to control
radiolysis.
To control.
Anyhow.
Radiolysis.
Yeah. There were things like that all the time. For some reason, don't ask me why, I got tagged for providing the facilities for doing tests inside reactors on fuels and stuff like that. And I did that for about 7 or 8 years. I must have spent tens of millions of dollars in that effort. And I used to have to travel all over. We had a big operation up in Canada where we did that sort of stuff.
You mean Westinghouse?
Yes, and I had whole crews up there working. And it was, one time I had 100 people working for me.
In many places. Yeah. So they are Canada?
Idaho.
That Canada was at Hamilton?
No.